I'm C.M. Magaña from the Strange and Unusual podcast, a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual host. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
This is Gemma Redgrave, and you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio.
Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. We invite you to join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi and beyond. Your GPR staff are Jay Witten.
You see how clever I was there? You make that connection? Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Keir Hansen.
Proactive. Reactive. Proactive. I'm making up words as I go here.
And Haley Malley.
Hey, that wasn't exactly what I was going to say at all, Jay. Thanks.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do occasionally discuss recent news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired in their home territories. But don't worry. If we dip too far into the future, we'll give you fair warning.
Welcome to episode 231 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where all we wanted to do was enjoy a little local festival, see the sights, have a bite, enjoy some live entertainment. If someone had told us we're going to have to deal with animal cruelties, child starvation, and blatant racism, we'd have packed a few extra brass knuckles. Seriously, you think you know your history. I am your host this week, Haley Malley, and with me in the GPR studios, I have Jay Witten. How are you today, Jay?
You know, I was just sitting over there, and this guy offered me something, and now he's gone. I don't know what the hell happened.
And Keir Hansen, how are you today, Keir?
Just making sure the floor feels nice and stable, that's all. Nice and solid. Well, this week, we are plunging feet first into the second outing for our Doctor Who writer, Sarah Dollard, in her contribution to Series 10, Thin Ice. The TARDIS being who she is, 12 and Bill are not going to head straight back to the university campus as they had planned, but rather are going to contend with a very long list of issues in Regency-era London. It's almost, at times, too much to fit into a single hour's programming, but you know, you pack it all in, and you've got an episode that burns hotter than coal, even underwater. So, general impressions. We'll take viewer contributions aside for a second and just get your immediate knee-jerk reactions on this. On first watch, Haley, what did you feel the moment the credits rolled?
I feel like I've seen this episode before.
Okay. How so?
It seemed very similar in theme to episodes we've had. It's very similar to, you know, Kill the Moon. It's similar to The Beast Below.
The trapped creature that needs to be rescued.
The human making the choice for the human race and not the Doctor.
Mm, okay, good points. Jay, did you get the same immediate pull from it, or did you go elsewhere?
You know, yeah, there were flavors that were a little bit similar, but this really, really worked for me in this instance, where, you know, The Beast Below I really didn't care for. The Moon is an Egg really fell flat for me. But this one, I have to say, is a standout episode. I really, really enjoyed this. And not just for the performances like last week. The story and the plot and everything that went into it was fantastic. So I really didn't mind the fact that some of these themes have been touched on before, because as a whole, it was a heck of a lot better. Mm.
I did notice some of the commonality to some of these thematic elements, but I mean, aside from, yes, I absolutely agree. I think they were executed much better than they may have been in the past. But I think it may just be a matter of establishing kind of this is the spirit of the Doctor, and it may be something where one of the reasons why it comes up more than once, just in New Who, is because this is something that really strikes home, and it's something that matters quite a bit. Apparently, not only to the Doctor, apparently it matters quite a bit to the TARDIS as well. If she's the one steering, you know, well, you don't exactly steer her.
You negotiate with her.
Please, can I please go home? So let's take that primary story. So we've got another monster captured and being exploited. Yeah, we see it quite a bit in New Who. We've even seen it in Torchwood. This reminded me a little bit of the meat episode where you got the star whale slowly being carved up. I wonder if this might have been a relative. Ugly cousin.
Great-grandmother.
but as far as, you know, everything kind of happened at a nearly frenetic pace throughout. There were very few slow, introspective moments. The way this was written and the way it was directed and edited as well, it seemed like it chose those very specific points to pull the brake and say, all right, let's dwell on this for just a second because we want something to hit home and then we're going to race back into it again. Was that effective or did you feel like it was a bit stop and go?
This one felt like it was a little too packed. Like there was almost too much to fit into this one episode, but then I don't think you could have turned it into a two-parter. There wasn't enough to fill out the two-parter, but it was. There were times where I was just like, okay, seriously, I need to stop and catch my breath. You know, you really didn't have a chance to take in what was going on at the moment before we're on to the next thing.
Okay, Haley.
I think the same thing. And the whole thing took place over 2 days,
at
right? Because there was that one night camping out with the kids.
Yep.
So. Yeah, it all just everything happened very quickly.
Right. I think personally, as far as how quickly everything flew together, I was okay with that because of the fact that this was a matter of the urgency of their actions was dictated by the immediacy of the demand. So because of the fact that they came into this at the point where they caught it at the last possible moment to interrupt Sutcliffe's plans, then that's it. They had to think quickly. And it wasn't... And as a result, and I think this is something that Dollard, again, is just really kind of killing, doesn't dwell on explanations for pseudoscience. Put a little in there to get you through, or to take... You know, again, I think this season is really kind of being cognizant of the desire to attract new viewers. So it's not... again, Bill is like that filter for what are you doing? What is this? Why do you have that? Why are you doing this? Why there's a wardrobe?
How is that any way a screwdriver?
Yeah, you got a whole room full of dresses, and she likes trouble. But the only thing as far as how quick everything fell into place really has to do me personally has to do with Bill, and that's you know we've seen in each of the episodes with her so far. She has been knocked back on her heels by something she's learning about the doctor. Like, not just casual stuff either. Not just, used to run about with a bad crowd or something. This was earth-shaking kind of stuff that she has to contend with. Or in the Smile episode where she's dealing with seeing the fate and near extinction of the human species. You know, so she's dealing with these very, very heady topics, and yet she has to get over it, you know, move past or move on from it so quickly. I don't know how long this can last. I don't know how long before I'm going to say, you know what? Nobody steps back from all these revelations just because you have to.
Yeah. No, and then we had that great moment after Spider gets sucked into the water where, you know, she's like, you can tell she is stunned. She doesn't know what to make of things. And she really takes that moment from the doctor. Like, he's ready to go. He's like, come on, let's do this thing. And she's like, no. I need a second here. Let's talk about this. And it really helped solidify the fact that this is all a new experience for her. This is stuff that she's not okay with. Right. And you have that great exchange between her and the doctor where he's like, I've seen people die. The best thing for you to do is move on. She's like, no, you can't move on from this.
Mm. I'm waiting for the moment, though, where she finally, you know, pulls up short and says no amount of flowery speech or carefully chosen words on your part is going to make this immediately better. And they really have to go head to head and heart to hearts on this because it's just, you know, she's taking in so much and she's rolling with it. But every week she's dealing with something more and more profound. And, you know, she's human. She's the human touch point here and has to grapple with this. And to her, death and loss and grief and those things matter so much, you know. And Pearl Mackey, she wears that so clearly, you know, so expressive in that regard. This face of trying to be enigmatic and it does all these things. So, and I could watch that all day. And so, I mean, to a certain degree, maybe I'm just being kind of selfish because as a viewer, I want to see more of that. I want to see her be able to work these things through. But also just because of the fact that since she is so human, I want to see her contend with this and force the doctor to take her through it without explaining it away. You know, grieve with her or you know, show some empathy. But so we dealt with the storyline of the monster beneath the ice. And then there's the doctor's contention about the, as he's dealing with Sutcliffe, where, and I'm just going to call this a monster within the human species. And the fact that it'd be easier to consider you extraterrestrial because of how inhumane you are. How did this work for you as far as just the representation of Sutcliffe and how he was presented?
Well, I kind of like that he started by trying to be very practical about it. He's like, well, I could have coal mines, but people die in the coal mines all the time. And the doctor's just like... The doctor brings the humanity into the conversation. He's like, no, like, these are human lives. These have value.
Right. Did we, how do we think about Nicholas Burns as Lord Sutcliffe, his balance of smarm and evil, you know, just, you always play that villain role very carefully about how over the top you're going to be. How did this work for you?
I thought it worked really well. I mean, the portrayal was great because it's like, as soon as you meet the guy, you can tell, you're like, I'm not going to like him, but you have no idea like just how bad he is. And he manages to do it without the mustache twirling. It's just, he is almost what I like to call like the Professor Umbridge type of villain, where it is so evil because it's so realistic, because you've run into somebody that's like this, you know, a racist person like this, that's only out for themselves, that doesn't have anything to do for anybody else. Hmm. And that's what makes him so bad, is the fact that every one of us know someone like that.
He didn't get too, he didn't play it too pompous or too posh to just say, all right, well, this is an over the top erudite role. And he's just going this as the, you know, the class role and the racist douchebag, you know, just up to this level. He didn't have to, he kind of pulled that back and just played it as, I'm privileged. I've always seen it this way. This is the way that I view the world. I can't even fathom seeing it in any other fashion, even when he gets knocked clear to the floor.
I don't think I've ever loved Peter Capaldi more than I did in that moment.
He was punching racists in the face.
This supplanted Duggan for my favorite punch in Doctor Who.
I actually started doing some scouring to try and figure out all the times. I mean, we've seen the Doctor do some dark stuff, you know, programming missiles to take out ships, you know, dinosaurs in a spaceship. We got rid of our baddie that way. We've had entire cyber fleets destroyed and things. He has gassed villains to death, you know, using cyanide gas and things. He's done all these things in the heat of the moment, as the battle or as the confrontation dictated. But just a straight out, you know, right hook kind of takedown, he's thrown very few punches, and I'm not counting Venusian karate. So I'm leaving that out of it. But yeah, you had, and it was usually towards guards, you know, get yourself past a guard kind of thing. There was something in like Seeds of Doom way back. But Matt Smith threw a punch. Victory of the Daleks. He knocked out the Doctor.
Mm. But it's always been a practical thing. Anytime the Doctor has thrown a punch, This is the quickest, most effective way to deal with the problem at hand. This was the first time we've ever seen him like lose his cool and throw a punch.
Well, and it's funny because he explained exactly why it was going to happen right before it happened.
Yeah.
Like that whole speech about like passion and tact and diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Passion fights. Diplomacy wins or whatever.
Yep.
But dealing with blatant racism. As far as other things that the doctor brought to the table here, you know, we're dealing with obviously this is his first instance where he's dealing with his new companion, where he is not totally in control of the situation. The TARDIS has decided the destination. The TARDIS has decided the problem that needs to be resolved. So he's on the learning curve instead of seeking something out and saying, you know, let me show you, you know, what we can do. I've read a lot of reviews. I've talked with a lot of folks who have said, "Oh, that shows me Capaldi's like pulling influences from so and so and so and so and so and so," and it runs the spectrum. I don't know necessarily that he's actually paying an homage to predecessors, or if this is just him and it happens to smack of previous Doctors. Did you kind of get a feel for any of the earlier iterations as he was going through this particular adventure?
Not until somebody mentioned it. Once somebody brought it up, it was kind of like, yeah, no, I can see that comparison. But it all fit with the persona that he has created for the 12th Doctor. It all fit so well that it didn't take me out of it. Mm-hmm. So if the homages were meant to be there, it was done artfully enough that it didn't say, "Hey, look, I'm impersonating Baker now."
Big hands, Matt Smith. Big hands.
No, that's what the hat was about.
Insistence upon hats. Give one away, steal another. Always hats. I will say, though, I watched on the second viewing, I watched him very carefully because of the fact that so many poignant questions were getting posed. So when Bill was really dressing him down about murder, about taking lives, about watching death, about how that impacts you and how you carry it beyond that point, I watched him really, really closely. And it ended up I ended up sort of scrutinizing his expressions all the way through to like the final scenes where, you know, the fish is racing down the Thames now and it's freed, and she's so elated, and she's like, do you hear that, and she looks over at him, and he's trying to keep it really expressionless. He's trying not to enjoy the moment openly. And you know, we've been talking about how he's continuing to discover new things about his Doctor. I mean, even now, knowing that we're in the final stretch of his tenure, and he's still, you know, honing little aspects of his persona. But this is something that I think is starting, to me personally, is starting to stand out more and more, is this sort of forced stoicism, where even though he may, in his words or in his actions, be expressing more and more passion about what's going on and really genuinely caring more about something, the things that when we first met him, he seemed to be very careless about. But yet he's trying to force himself into reserve. And I'm just sort of trying to figure out exactly what he's attempting to do there, because it was so blatant in this episode where he was trying to remain deadpan as she was either really angry or really happy or really concerned. And he kept visibly, you know, tightening it down.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a theory to why he may be doing this specifically with Bill and why he's trying not to enjoy moments with her, smile with her, worry with her?
I kind of think it goes back to he's trying to make sure this companion doesn't get too wrapped up in excitement and adventure and, you know, make sure that this one remembers to play safe.
Okay. But yet he's not going to keep her from those adventures.
Well, no, that's just crazy talk.
It's a tough line to walk.
Be a very boring show that way.
So you want to play dominoes?
You want to go look at the vault again? Still there. Still closed.
So one of the predominant messages that keeps coming through this episode is the idea of moving on and how much you take to heart and how much you have to just address it and say, okay, this is what it is. Can't necessarily be changed. Can't necessarily be cleaned up. And I can either let it tear me apart, or I can, you know, either brush it off and move on, or I can learn from it and adapt from it and move on. I think more importantly than the Doctor's discussion about the importance of doing so was Bill's realization of how she has to try to incorporate that. But I'm not sure that it sat quite right, or that it had enough time. Again, it kind of goes back to, you know, how quickly she turns around on these things. You know, listening to him have, you know, story time with the kids, and then, you know, by the close of that, everything seems to be okay. You know, she has one conversation with Kitty, and
Was the conversation with Kitty was kind of telling in that regard, though, because she, you know, Kitty's like, you know, you guys fought. She's like, yeah, but you're okay now. She's like, yeah, that's kind of how things work out. It's, you know, we can disagree and still be friends. You know, I may not agree with what he's saying about it, but you know, he still hasn't given me any reason not to trust him. So it's, I mean, I'm reading a lot into it at this point, obviously.
No, but that's what we had to do because the scene was so quick. We kind of have to fill that backstory. Or at least, you know, dig into that subtext to a certain degree, because it happened within less than 60 seconds of screen time.
Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, that's what I took away from it, was it was kind of that thing of like, you know, we've been through some stuff and I may not like the way he's doing it, but he hasn't steered me wrong yet. We can deal with this at a later time when it's not so pressing.
Okay.
It was very reminiscent of, you know, the scene that we talked about in class where you had the two characters that were, you know, disagreeing on the way something was happening, and it's like, yeah, but that's between us and we can deal with that later on, you know.
Right.
Well, and just this season so far, we went immediately from the first episode adventure where the things happened where she was at, and then they immediately went on the next adventure to the Emoji Bot planet, and then trying to come home from that adventure, they landed in this adventure. So she hasn't had like a break between crazy outings like we've seen other companions get, or, you know, some time just chilling on the TARDIS. She's boom, 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 been hit with these things. Yeah. And now she's back on Earth for maybe some period of time, and she will get a chance to process what she's gone through.
Yeah, I would say, you know, natural progression time, she's probably slammed through all this inside of about 96 hours. And her eyes have been open to so much that again, this kind of goes back to, you know, the writers working, you know, on their encapsulated stories, that if you wanted, if you wanted really character driven and you wanted some serious continuity here, by about the fourth adventure, she's got to be jaded and really concerned. She's like, all right, are we going like to like the Carvel planet where we're all going to get a nice cone and everyone's just going to talk about the sunsets for a little while? Because I'm not sure, until I get about a week to process this, I'm not sure I can take much more.
No, something really terrible happens on all the vacation planets. Don't go there.
Yeah.
I would like to see kind of like a backlash for all of this, where Bill like literally cannot deal anymore and they have to take a moment to where, you know, she and the doctor finally hash stuff out or talk about things or something. But I know next week it looks like we're going to have an episode that takes a bit of time after this. You know, there's a gap there. So it'll probably just be inferred that she's had a chance to relax a little bit. Mm-hmm. So,
and maybe there's some residual impact, but that would have to be obviously Moffat's hand, because as you go through for that story, correct me, is next week Toby Whithouse's story? I'll check. But it's, again, it's one of those things where if you're expecting something to be some baggage that's carried over, then that's going to have to be something that, that Moffat asked for interjection on that. Mm-hmm. So we've now seen three different writers deal, or I should say, present their take on the 12 and Bill dynamic. I know we were talking right before we started about how we kind of personally feel this episode rates with the three we've gotten now as a whole. But in terms of the in terms of just that component of it, just in terms of grasping the doctor character, doctor companion rapport, how would you feel our different writers have done with getting something that really sparks?
Yeah, I think it works really well so far. I think that, you know, they've got a relationship that's not two dimensional. You see different aspects of it, but it all feels realistic. It's not, you know, this person sees it differently than that person. It all feels like this, you know, a part of the same relationship. Mm.
It's not 7B Clara and the Doctor. It's got the consistency of maybe season 8. You know, we're seeing a cohesive relationship developing between them. It's not just bouncing all over the place.
Mm. Okay. I think I will say that I'm very surprised that between our three writers at this point, Moffat obviously writing for a character that he has crafted, Cottrell Boyce taking it and throwing it into, you know, your future adventure, Dollard now taking them into a period piece. I think regardless of whose pen it is that's crafting their dialogue, I honestly think that Mackie and Capaldi have come up with a great dynamic between the two of them that I don't even think the editing has to keep it as tight as it presents.
You know, and I think that is a lot of it, is it's the actors have figured out how to portray their characters regardless of what the dialogue is. You know, they know how their characters would feel in any given situation. And you know, like Haley alluded to with Clara, she had no idea what her character was at the very beginning. You know, she was a mystery to everyone, right, even the writers. So there was no clear way to portray that. Whereas we have very solid characters with the 12th Doctor and Bill, and they can read something on the page and say, okay, well, I think it would be, you know, portrayed this way, or you know, it twisted around just a little bit so that it fits the character that they have. Mm.
Again, now we're going to get an opportunity to see, you know, a bevy of additional writers be able to present some dialogue to them in increasingly harrowing situations. We know we've got some pretty major stuff to contend with over the next few episodes. We got a little bit of a hint of it in the little coda at the close of this one, where a bit of banging at the door, knocking at the door, drumming at the door.
I was thinking the same thing.
But the wrong count.
Yes. Yes.
That's the part that threw me off.
Well, maybe he's very tired.
I got 1, 2, 3.
This door is so heavy. My hand hurts.
He was knocking 4 times earlier, but we didn't see that part.
We did get an opportunity. The speech, I should say speech, it was actually... there was the moment where obviously he's addressing Sutcliffe and he's talking about the nature of what defines, you know, the humanity and the species. The species speech, if you will. The one that strikes home, not only to the point where it gets Sutcliffe himself to say, what a lovely bit of words you just said, you know, but Bill's dwelling on it later, you know, as they're being taken off in the coach. The moment I saw that, we tweeted out to Sarah Dollard, and I had to ask her, how many times did you have to go through that on an edit and say, you know, is this something that you kind of had to pore over a little bit? Because it surprised me personally that it was not one of the big, get up on your high horse kind of speeches. This was quiet. And for all the people that have been complaining that Capaldi is a shouty actor and yet another one of these shouty actors that just comes up there and
you know, tries to win by volume. Yeah,
precisely. You know, really, the orchestra swells beneath them and he's jowls shaking. This was delivered quietly, calmly, surgically. And it really wasn't very long. It's only about 3 lines. But it has that kind of impact. So I asked her, you know, how many times do you have to go through it? And she got right back to us and said, this is one of those few moments where you're able to kind of nail it on the first pass. You know, she said it doesn't happen often, but it was pretty much first draft. So that's, I guess you kind of consider that one of those inspired moments. But did that, do you feel that it had the gravity that it needed for the moment? I mean, you know, as it impresses the villain, it impresses the companion, so forth.
I think that it didn't have, like you said, you know, the orchestra didn't swell. It didn't have that cue to be like, hey, big important stuff is going on right now. Pay attention to what's being said. But for anyone that was like really paying attention to the dialogue, that was really listening to it, or yeah, and even Bill's reaction to it gave you that sense of like, wow, that is some serious stuff right there. And you can't help but go back and listen to it again. You know, it was one of those moments where I actually, you know, kind of like leaned back in my chair and I was like, wow, that was wow.
I dare say it's a pretty clear political statement.
Yeah.
Being made through the writer's text here. You know, what you do for the least of us, kind of a message. You know, take it from a very secular standpoint, but it has, I mean, you see it occur in a lot of religious texts as well. You know, you do for the least fortunate to define yourself as the most compassionate, which brings you closer to the divine. I mean, that's really what it all boils down to. And it may be a very clear message about the fact that we may be drifting away from this on a large scale at the moment. There were a lot of very clear messages in that regard coming through. It's one of the reasons why I was really pleased that Sarah Dollard was given the opportunity to write again for this season. so was Jesus. history is a whitewash. That was a freaking mic drop line.
That was. Oh, that was hilarious. And it, I mean, it's true. And that's something that, you know, we've actually got in our news story later on. But this was an important topic that needed to be addressed. I mean, you've got a period piece, so obviously it's, you know, viewers are used to kind of brushing it under the rug because nobody wants to deal with that topic. It's just like, we're going to ignore it because it's too. And, you know, Moffat and Sarah Dollard kind of said, no, this is, we're going to address it. And it didn't take much. You really didn't have to spend a lot of time on it. It was just kind of like, yeah, slavery is a thing.
Yeah.
It's dangerous, but, you know, it's.
And it's not something that's going to be solved
within
this episode. It's addressed, it's contended with, it's present, you know, it's unavoidable, but it's something that that even aside to that, there was just obviously the addressing that, well, there's a lot more diversity going on here. You know, there's more than Bill would have expected.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, history's written by the conquerors, by those in positions of power. So if they didn't want to address the fact that there was a lot of melanated people around, and it was a far more, you know, multicultural society, even in 1814, than you may see depicted in woodcuts, you know, just look at who's actually drafting. It doesn't mean that they were treated very well, but it's definitely something that I'm glad that they're making a conscious effort to say, you know what, we're not going to apologize for this. We are not going to continue the whitewashing that was clearly relevant or was clearly apparent.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think Doctor Who has ever really fallen into that. Well, I should say New Who. I mean, they've mm-hmm. always done a respectable job of at least trying to make sure that. Well, respectable. There's a long way to go. But you've always seen this, especially with a lot of things like the future depictions.
Yeah.
You know, you notice that a lot of your scientists, your interstellar explorers and things, they've always made sure, have always represented the fact that the future is not nearly as Caucasian as has been traditionally depicted in sci-fi.
Yeah, and I think the best way to say it is that Doctor Who has always been ahead of the curve for the time that it was released in.
Mm.
It's, you know, you can go back to some of the classic Who, and it's like, wow, they were really, they, you know, that's abhorrent today, but for the time, that was, you know, that was more than anybody else was doing. And I think that's the thing, is that they continue to make progress for the day that it's released.
Mm. And far, you know, and the scale is far, far more at this point. And I think, as we'll get to in the news, I think it's something where, you know, thankfully what Moffat has been starting to express as his intent with episodes like this, and working with the writers as he has, that I think he wants to hand over a legacy that is very progressive in that respect, or as progressive as it can be, moving over to a showrunner who's another straight white male. So there you go. But yeah, anything else we want to... I did note from a technical aspect, I thought it was kind of cool to have the counterbalance of the period costumes that were, you know, huge bright colors, and even down the street urchins, they're wearing bright yellows and greens and things, and the red hat on poor little spider. Poor little spider. against a really, really drab gray city depiction. You know, just, I thought that was just an interesting kind of juxtaposition between the two. So, and I did see a couple articles. There was one piece that went around that was talking about the models that they ended up using for the deep sea dive scenes. They mm-hmm. wanted originally to actually do practical tank dives and have Capaldi and Mackey in diver suits.
Can't imagine why that didn't happen.
But wouldn't that have been freaking cool? So they ended up having to do these scale clay models. And I will have to find the link. I will try and share it in the notes before we publish here. But they did all of these scale Capaldi heads with this angry expression done in this beautifully carved clay model heads that I would pay hundreds, nay, thousands for one of these things. They are just so freaking cool. Just the expression of his that they capture, them alone. And then you get the whole little figure with it, with a deep diver suit and everything. Just look freaking awesome. Yeah.
I can't imagine why they didn't want to put their two lead actors in a real deep sea dive on the third episode they're shooting for the season.
Yeah.
They just needed just the scene where they punch through the ice and drop. So all you need is just one shot of them in a pool, you know, add the rest. But I think, I mean, as far as the way that some of those scenes at the bottom of the Thames played out, I didn't really mind the CG so much.
No,
it's fine.
It got the point across, and it wasn't, I mean, it was dark, and so, yeah, it worked.
Whole episode was very, very dark, just in general. I mean, just the tones were extremely shadowed.
I have to say, though, I completely agree with Frank Cottrell Boyce actually tweeted this out after the episode aired and said no one, not Abe Lincoln, Fred Astaire, Duke Ellington, no one looks better in a top hat than the Doctor.
Yeah,
totally agree. I'm like, yep. Anything we've got to do to get him back in this outfit.
Costume work is fantastic. Just keep handing him tea so he can put on his tea drinking
special tea clothes
all the time. Just cravats and morning coats all day long.
I have to say, I'm impressed with the guts it took to kill off a child and not bring him back.
Yeah. Like,
I'm thoroughly pleased by the fact. I hate any show that depicts violence against kids or anything bad happening to kids, but this worked. And I'm glad they didn't try and be like, oh, hey, look, he was right here in a bubble the whole time.
The fish burped him up before it ran down the river.
You've seen Pinocchio, right? Same thing.
Because, I mean, if you go back and if you look at the speech that the Doctor gives, it adds so much more punch to it when it was an actual loss of life. And not just a perceived one.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the first death that Bill witnessed, it's not some like bad crony dude. It is a child. Mm-hmm.
See, when Dollard writes a death, it's meant to stick.
Yeah.
Especially when there's a bird shot to the chest. It's meant to stick.
It works anyway. Much better if it does.
The season finale, they're bringing back that kid.
Oh, God damn it.
Is he going to be standing alongside the kid that Danny Pink saved? The two of them?
Cooey, yep. We're back.
They're going to do a Coke commercial together.
All right.
Let's go into the news.
Get me out of here.
Completely run off the rails now.
Well, as we were mentioning, as far as that little final scene there, the Radio Times has been hypothesizing about this. Well, everybody's been hypothesizing about this. So they got a couple of things that they noticed that we'll make sure that we include here, too. And one had to do with the banging, the knocking, the pounding, the drumming on the vault door in Nardal's final scene. Interesting, you know, what did you think about Lucas's behavior at the end there? You know, it comes down to the vault grumbling and he's fixing everything. And then he starts arguing with the noise on the other side of the door. And you start to see a little bit of an edge from Nardal.
Yeah. It's like he was given a task and now it's like, well, I'm trying to do my job and I'm catching crap for it.
He seems to be more concerned about the contents of the vault than the Doctor.
Right. Well, yeah. And if the Doctor's not there to deal with whatever's in there, then it falls on Nardal. And it's not something he wants to deal with alone.
Mm. Right.
So, theory obviously being that if this knocking is following any kind of pattern, that may be our segue into our sim master of some fashion. But then you'd have to figure out, well, if that's that iteration of the master in the vault, then what does that mean for Missy? And you know, where are our timelines crossing one another? And in one fashion.
Well, I mean, one of the theories that's been put out there is the fact that if we're getting Sim's master back, then, and it's, you know, reportedly after the end of time, then is Missy really who she claims to be?
Right.
So that could, I mean, it could be that we have the actual master trapped up in the vault and Missy is just some rogue time lady running around causing mayhem.
I really don't like that.
No, I don't either. I would not want to rob Missy of her masterhood. That ain't right. If you suddenly say, oh, well, it's been the Ronnie all along. No, no.
No.
The Ronnie was amoral. She was not chaotic evil.
Yeah.
She was just a scientist without scruples. She was not bat guano crazy. Yeah. Another thing that Radio Times did kind of catch on. And I thought I couldn't figure out where this was kind of coming from. And I thank them for being far more on point than I am with all their unlimited resources, was mentions of previous Frost Fairs. Bill says, you seem to know a lot about this and things. He said, I've been here a few times. And there was actually the discussion from River's perspective about when they were going through past adventures that she had traveled to the right. Frost Fair with the Doctor, specifically, if I remember correctly, in 1814.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
So everyone was saying, whoa, does that mean that we're going to see, there's a simultaneous scene going on and somewhere in the background, you just see a big mop of hair go by dipping into a tent?
I would absolutely love it if just for the heck of it, Matt Smith and Alex Kingston came back on to do a cameo, but you never actually see their faces. Like, it'd be a cameo in the style of the
Five-ish Doctors, where they're all under sheets.
That was actually them on screen, but you have no way of knowing that.
I was the fourth urchin, half under the table. Quick, we won't dwell too long on it because, it doesn't really warrant going on too much about. But as far as our viewing numbers here, how did Thin Ice do versus our predecessors?
So our Thin Ice got an overnight viewing figure of 3.76 million.
That's down about a half a mil from last week, right?
Yeah, about that. So we're down almost a solid million from the pilot.
I don't get it. Well, wait a minute, though. But as far as the pilot, when you start counting it, because we were looking at like the plus ones.
Yeah. So on the live plus seven or the cumulative, I don't think we even have live plus seven yet. But the pilot actually gained 2 million viewers. So we're sitting at 6.68 million for the pilot now.
Okay.
So, we've talked about it countless times before, but this just proves that your audience is not always going to be sitting there the night that it airs.
Right. And you could also make the argument that people for the premiere were going to make an effort to see it as it aired. And then later in the season, they're going to watch them whenever they watch them.
Exactly. Things are going to come up and it's not going to be as important for you to see it right then. Right.
Yeah. It's not as much of a viewing event.
Right.
Okay.
We did wind up with the audience appreciation index of 83 for Smile, which is the same thing we got for the pilot. So,
yeah. Okay. Huh. That's surprising.
Yeah. Because, you got so much better feedback from the pilot than you did from Smile. But
it seemed to be. But then again, that's general viewing audience consensus. So that's, maybe there's something about that sort of an episode that appeals to a different band of the viewership that we're just not accounting for. You have to have that mix to satisfy everyone over the course of a season. So,
but while we're talking about viewing figures, so Class, as we've complained about repeatedly,
we have not complained about Class.
No. We've complained about the way that it was portrayed. It is now finally airing in the U.S. So the U.S. audiences are now able to sit and watch this. The ones who don't have Canadian satellites. So the viewing figures that we're getting now is the first episode of Class got 0.5 million viewers, and that dropped substantially to 0.3 for the second episode. That's a drop of almost 43%.
Yeah. We're not going to see a second season of Class.
Unless this really, really picks up. No, we're not going to, but I think that the problem is that anyone that was really interested in seeing the show didn't wait the five.
They found a way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because, you take something that fans love and want to access and tell them to wait, even though
tell half of them, you can watch it. You over there, you can't.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So I don't know. Unfortunately. Yeah. I do think that this is the death knell for this particular series.
Yeah, call it a comedy of errors.
Except it's not funny in the slightest.
No, not really. And the unfortunate thing is now you get to sit there and wonder the what ifs. What if it aired simultaneously? What if even just now, if you did choose to make the U.S. and Australian viewing audiences wait, what if you aired it before Doctor Who? Granted, that would put it on at a time of day where maybe that content wouldn't be quite appropriate for primetime Saturday night viewership.
It's on cable, though.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're going to run Torchwood episodes during the day. But yeah, so then you get to sit there and play the what-if game, which meanwhile everything's just kind of dissolving around you, which is so unfortunate because as we've talked about ad nauseum, we think the show really had a lot of credibility and a lot of ability to survive. It had legs. Sorry, Ram. It had a leg.
Too soon.
Not soon enough. But yeah, it's just you couldn't have screwed this one up worse if you tried. And it's almost as if they're trying.
Do you think they might wrap it up with, like, one last adventure in Doctor Who?
I would love to see them reference the Coal Hill School kids in a Doctor Who episode just to say, you know what, we're cognizant of it. I don't know if we're going to be able to save this, but you, an amazing effort, and it's not for lack of trying, and we're right here with you. But
yeah, the likelihood of that happening, it's just really not going to.
It's not looking good.
No.
Maybe some comics.
Yeah, because there's an industry that's surviving.
Well, as we referenced before, there's an article that came out a couple days ago about how Stephen Moffat and Sarah Dollard decided to address the racism in this episode. And they said, you know, they really didn't see an alternative to it. And it's a fantastic article that just they kind of, you know, goes over everything we've already discussed, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, this is something that you can't continue to just say, it's not a problem. We're just going to ignore it because we don't know how to deal with it. So
yeah, you can't just continually kick a can down the road and just say, you know what? Well, this is, you know, it's not the right time to address this. It's been the right time for a long time.
Exactly. So yeah, it's good stuff that they went ahead and put it in there, and I'm glad. But yeah, definitely go over and check out the article because it kind of gives you a little bit of insight into their thought process as they addressed it.
We also got a little bit of a peek ahead at what we will have for our episode Oxygen, which will be 2 weeks hence. So we'll have Knock Knock next week and then Jamie Matheson's Oxygen. So this is our deep space, you know, trapped sort of a space station sort of bottle episode kind of thing here. So this should be just from what I've been gathering, this is to me feels like it's going to smack quite a bit of episodes we've had in the past, storylines we've had in the past. But again, this is Doctor Who. This is one of their go-tos.
Space zombies.
Yeah. Space zombies. But they talk about dealing with survival against the, quote from the BBC, darkest evil of all. This has also been, I think, as Moffat was describing it back when he was doing the series synopsis before the pilot aired, he said that this was going to be the episode that was the literal view from behind the couch creepy episode. This was the one that brought something into it that he had been waiting for because Matheson had found something wholly new and terrifying. Whether he's just given that lip service or whether we're talking about an emergence of something that is like Weeping Angels level of creepy remains to be seen.
Yeah.
And so what else we got? Anything to wrap up?
Do we want to talk about this last one?
Yes, we do.
Do we have to?
Yes, we
it's
do.
It's Jay's favorite writer, Mark Gatiss. He was apparently not offered the role of showrunner.
What?
Yeah, honestly, I'm sitting here and I grabbed this news article because some of the opening lines from it, you know, it sounded interesting, and I was able to throw it in there right before we started recording. But as I've been reading over it, it almost seems like, well, I want to say something just to get my name back out there, but
so it sounds like so and so would be honored to have the role as the 13th Doctor,
exactly,
who was not asked whether or not they wanted to be the 13th Doctor.
No, but he says that he was fine that he wasn't approached for the showrunner position, which is, you know, seems an awfully diplomatic way of saying, I don't want to piss off the people who I might get a job from later. But he says, you know, I don't have any idea what will happen in the future. I don't have plans to write for the show next year. And it's kind of nice to watch with no idea what will happen. So
very diplomatic.
But I can also agree with that, too. It's, you know, he's written an episode for the show for every season of Moffat's run. So it's probably nice to take a break and actually be like, you know what? I'm just going to enjoy the show, because he is a fan of the show.
Absolutely.
And he's been involved in it for the past, what, 5 years? So for him to actually be able to sit down and say, you know what? I'm just going to go back to being a fan. I can totally buy that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know that it's breaking your heart that he's going to take that hiatus.
Oh, totally.
But you know,
he wants to put the extra time into crafting the sequel to Sleep No More.
Sleep a little bit more.
A short nap
before dying.
I like that he put in here that he's totally on board with the 13th Doctor being a woman. And he says, you know, it's a brilliant idea. Why not? Can't argue that a character who has two hearts, is 2,000 years old, travels through time and space in a police box, can't change sex.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no justification for why you can't, in all of the permutations, all the different options, every time you roll the dice for a new, you know, a new character archetype. How many times can you flip a coin and it keeps coming up heads? No.
Depends on if you're watching American Gods or not.
Yeah. Or playing coin games with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. But,
well, that is all that we've got for the news this week. Next week we will be returning with Knock Knock and our elusive landlord, figure out who the heck he is and what he's up to.
Who carries around a tuning fork?
You don't?
I carry a tuning spork. It's not quite as effective, but it's
good. You can eat your cereal with it, though. So.
Yeah.
Comes in real handy when you need to know the resonant frequency of a soup.
Yes. What do you got there, minestrone? D-flat.
Well, not according to my sonic spork.
All right. Well, this has been episode 231 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, so the TARDIS has dresses and likes a little bit of trouble. Yeah, I think I'm low-key in love with her.
And this is Kira saying, it's not really wrestling unless it's in zero gravity, with tentacles and magic spells.
And this is Haley saying, Admiral, I'm receiving whale song.
Which way to Sydney?
We'll see you guys next week.
Hallowsy.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Welcome to episode 231 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Where we all wanted to do... I want to read this for a second.
Wait a minute. Who the hell put the words in this order?
That don't make no sense.